for International Year of Astronomy, and it's called the Scottish Solar System. Now, it sounds a bit parochial, but it's a very interesting little... I suppose it's really just a coincidence, but let me just very briefly tell you about it and then explain how that fits into this course. I attended a launch event for it at the end of February, where International Year of Astronomy was launched in Edinburgh, a number of events that we have running in Scotland. This is just one of them. And the idea behind the Scottish Solar System is quite simple. There's a lot of amateur astronomy societies around the country, and some of you are members of them. Perhaps, and certainly that's been the case with many DAIS classes in the past. And we're indebted to the work that they do organising astronomy events and lectures and public observing. And I was aware around October of last year that there were many such events being planned for spring, what the astronomical powers have designated Spring Moonwatch Week, which is March 28th to April 4th. And I noted just one of those strange coincidences that comes to light, that if you make the Glasgow Science Centre the sun, then the locations of the astronomy societies around Scotland make an extremely good scale model of the solar system. See, I don't think this has any cosmic significance at all, but nonetheless, what we're aiming to do is to use this as a way to just perhaps get a wee bit more press coverage for events that are happening through 2009. So basically, I've built this website. Because we don't have web access up here in the Boyd Orr, or at least I don't have access to the relevant network, then I've just copied a couple of pages to let you see what it's all about. I mean, it's kind of mainly aimed at schools, actually. I hope you've got the flavour of that through this course, that a lot of what I do by way of outreach is aimed at schools, although I enjoy very much doing the DAIS classes also. But if you click, well, let me just go back, you know, imagine that this was a real web page and you could click on where it says upcoming events. What that would then take you to is a calendar. And on Monday, March 30th, you'll see that at 8 o'clock we've got scheduled Glasgow University Observatory Open Evening, which is basically why I can't be here to give you a 10th lecture. But it occurs to me that for those of you who can make it, and it's of course by no means obligatory, and as far as any of these lectures are obligatory, you would be most welcome to come along. And I can't promise that we will make it a regular lecture, because in fact if it's clear, then as it is tonight, what we'll be doing is giving people the opportunity to do some real observing. Now that might be of interest to you anyway, but of course if it's cloudy, or partly cloudy, then there's a wee lecture room in our observatory where we can, you know, tie up a few loose ends for this course in a way that, you know, will not disenfranchise anyone who's not been at the previous 9 weeks, who's just come along for the open evening. We're not expecting dozens and dozens of people, so there should be room for everyone. So if anyone's interested, you'd be most welcome to come along. If you want to get directions to
the University
Observatory, bear with me, I'm just going to show you in the next slide. So basically, again, in my simulation of a web page, because I can't show you the real thing, if you click on our Google Calendar for these events, then this is what you would see. Glasgow University Observatory Open Evening. It's Acre Road in Garscube. And the map, if you click on that, it will take you to basically a Google Map page where it's just up Maryhill. Oh, it's just disappeared off the top. That's a shame. That's it there. Up Maryhill Road, just close to the Science Park, just short of Canesburn Toll. So I was unsure until a few nights ago whether I would be able to do the Monday the 30th open evening. We're having them all that week. I think I mentioned before it's my daughter's 5th birthday and the day before my wedding anniversary, so a bit of negotiation was required, but I'm free on that night. I'd be delighted to see some of you if you can make it. Actually, we have open nights all that week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, not the Friday, because we have an event at the Science Centre that same night for school children. But Alec McKinnon will be hosting the 31st. I'll probably be there again on the Wednesday, Thursday. So you can sort of take your pick, but if you would like to come along next Monday evening, we can regard it as a kind of semi-formal continuation of this course, but as I say, by no means obligatory. And if you need some directions to the observatory, then, you know, come and see me at the break and I can work out a way to get them to you. I can certainly post them on the website for Hubble Vision, for example, or indeed just direct you towards our university homepage. But, you know, the directions are fairly good on the Google Map, and you can get at that via the Scottish Solar System webpage. So that's the address you need, scottishsolarsystem.org.uk. click on upcoming events, click on Glasgow University Observatory Open Evening, Monday, March 30th, or indeed the other nights when it's on, and then that will take you to the details. So it depends a lot on the weather, whether we would have more of a chat and a lecture, or whether we'll actually be out there using some real telescopes, but either way, you'd be most welcome. Okay?
Or you have to book, you can just turn up.
Yeah, don't have to book, just turn up. You know, there is a tiny possibility that there'll be 200 people will turn up, but I doubt it somehow. Past experience would suggest, you know, a few dozen at most, and we'll be delighted if we get that many each night. Indeed, we did this many years ago when I was a graduate student. When Halley's Comet was visible, we organised some open evenings, and, you know, even then, with the, you know, the specific thing that you had to see Halley's Comet during that narrow window of time, we still only had, I think, about 50 was the maximum number we had in any given night. And we do intend to run these open evenings in the autumn as well. So if you can't make it next week, you know, watch this space and you'll find out more. Okay. So that gives us a chance for a bit of an encore for Hubble and all that. But for tonight, what I'd like to do is talk to you a bit about cosmology and galaxies, and what Hubble has taught us about cosmology and galaxies. So there'll be a slight overlap in some of these slides with the slides that my graduate student Russell Johnson presented at the day school on the 14th of March, but not too much overlap. But what I would like to do tonight is try to reach the end of a very much an ongoing story, but at least to get to the end of the part that Hubble has contributed to, which is our understanding of how the universe is evolving and how galaxies formed. So let me just begin by showing a slide that we showed before, which was Hubble, the man rather than Hubble the telescope, using the 100-inch reflector in Mount Wilson, just outside Los Angeles, to measure redshifts of distant galaxies. And what he found was, for the distant ones, although notably not M31, the Andromeda galaxy, our nearest neighbour, the tendency was for the galaxies to have their spectral lines redshifted, giving rise to the term that we call the cosmological redshift, which we interpret as due to the expansion of the universe. The effect is mathematically analogous to what happens when you see the sound waves from a receding object being stretched, the change in pitch of, say, a police car siren. But when you're talking about light, the effect is a lot smaller, harder to measure, but you can do it using spectra. Just to give you another cartoon version of what we're talking about, this is what a spectrum might look like. It's got certain lines in it, and how they manifest themselves is that if you plot the amount of energy you're getting as a function of the wavelength of the light or the colour of the light, then there'll be certain bits of the spectrum where there's a lot of light. Now, this is what we call an emission spectrum. If it's an absorption spectrum, which is a bit more like what we showed in the previous slide, which is a dark line where the light is missing, well, all you've really got to do is turn this yellow curve upside down and you've got the same idea. It's a dip in the amount of energy. So a nearby galaxy, such as one of these nice open spirals, this is M101 I think, might have its spectral lines in those positions. Those spectral lines will be due to certain chemical elements, very often hydrogen, because galaxies contain lots of stars and stars contain lots of hydrogen. If you look at a more distant galaxy, then those spectral lines will be shifted systematically towards longer wavelengths, which means redder colours. So maybe a spectral line that would appear in the yellow part of the spectrum would be shifted towards the orange or even the red. So, as we saw in the previous session, by the late 1920s, Hubble had turned this into the plot that we see here, which shows the relation between distance and, if you interpret the redshift as the speed of recession, then the kind of numbers you're talking about are a few hundred kilometres per second. Hubble actually labelled his diagram wrongly, but so we'll let him off, because it was a very profound result he was recording, which was that nearby galaxies generally are moving more slowly away from us, distant galaxies are generally moving faster. But as we said last time, the interpretation that we put on this is that they're not really moving at all, it's that the space between the galaxies is stretching, the universe is expanding. So The measurement of the expansion rate, well, let me just go back to this previous slide one more moment, is essentially given by the slope of this line. Now, there's two lines shown here, so even Hubble couldn't quite make up his mind what the slope was. That's because of uncertainties in the distances and uncertainties in the measured speeds of the galaxies. And that's an issue that stayed with us for a long time. And it was only really in the 1980s that the answers began to moderately converge. Up until that point, there was a very, very big discrepancy between the initial values that Hubble had measured and then the evolving values through the 50s, 60s. Now, these are rather odd units. Kilometres per second per megaparsec. A megaparsec is a million parsecs, or about 3.25 million light years. So what that says is that for every 3.25 million light years further out that you go in space, it tells you how much faster the galaxies appear to be moving away from us. Now, Hubble got this Hubble constant, as we now call it, to be something like 500 or 600 kilometres per second for every megaparsec increase in distance. And that was a wee bit embarrassing. If you don't worry if you're not sort of accustomed to thinking in these terms, but if you look at these units, kilometres is a unit of length, megaparsec is also a unit of length, so they kind of cancel each other out in some sense. What you're left with is a unit of 1 over time. So if you take the Hubble constant and then say 1 over the Hubble constant, what you've got is something that should have units of time. And that's really a measure of how old the universe is. Because what you're saying is distance equals speed times time. And if the universe had been expanding at the same rate ever since the Big Bang, then it tells you how long you've got to go back in time before everything's on top of everything else. And the whole universe is just concentrated at a single point. So it sets a time scale for the expansion, not actually the age of the universe, because of course, who says the universe has been expanding at the same rate? As we talked about 2 weeks ago, the evidence suggests, in fact, that it's actually speeding up. But in addition, we have pretty good evidence that in the past it was slowing down. So it's certainly not been expanding at a constant rate. But the point is, it gives you a rough estimate of what the time scale for the expansion is. And if the Hubble constant was really as high as Hubble initially measured it to be, then rather embarrassingly, the age of the universe would be roughly about 2 billion years, which even in Hubble's day was embarrassingly low, because geologists suggested that the Earth's rocks were several billion years old, like more like 4, 4.5. So you can't have the Earth older than the universe. So something was wrong, and it turned out that it was like Hubble had basically got his distances wrong. So a few weeks ago, we talked about how the Hubble telescope had contributed to measuring the distances on very large scales much more precisely. So it's not simply a matter of precision, it's also a matter of accuracy. Because effectively, what Hubble got wrong was what we term a systematic error. I think I've sort of alluded to this before. It's a bit like saying, if I measure the length of this bench and I use a ruler measured in centimetres, but I don't realise that and I think they're actually inches, I'm always going to get the wrong answer. Okay, no one's going to make such a mistake, perhaps, but nonetheless, if you do, then no matter how many times you repeat your measurement, you're still going to get it wrong. So Hubble was effectively using the wrong ruler because he had the luminosity of his Cepheids wrong compared with what we now understand. So that's largely why the values came down. But there was still broad disagreement through the 1980s and 90s when I got involved, and each one of these little black circles is someone's best guess as to what the Hubble constant was from particular data sets. So there was a whole bunch of people thought it was around 50, and a bunch of other people who thought it was around 100. It turns out we think the answer is about 70. So if we'd just taken an average of all those values in the 1980s, we would have got it right anyhow. But what the Hubble telescope has helped to do is to resolve the problems that existed with those measurements of distance through the 80s and 90s. And now the agreement, consensus over this expansion rate of the universe has really settled down. And it's one of the numbers that we think we know rather well, to within about 5%, which may not sound very good, but you know, we're talking about making measurements over vast distances, and I think that's pretty good going. So that's where we stand with the current expansion rate of the universe. As we talked about 2 weeks ago, by taking the expansion much further out, because see, that's the distance covered by Hubble's original work, just a little red square. If you go much further out, you get more and more distant supernovae. We're still not at a regime where we would expect the straight line to start to deviate from being a straight line, but not too much beyond what the graph shows here, you do indeed start to see that change. And again, we talked briefly about that 2 weeks ago. Let's now just fill in a bit more detail. It's that that's led us to the belief that the universe is actually speeding up, and moreover, that it was in the distant past slowing down. And I promised, well, everyone, but I say Mark had asked a question about the very latest data. So here's a graph I showed you before. The first hint we got that the universe really did go through this change from deceleration to acceleration came with a supernova that was really just discovered more by luck than design in the Hubble Deep Field. So we don't have a redshift for it directly, but we can sort of roughly estimate what its redshift is from its colour. Because remember, the more it's redshifted, the more the light of its spectrum is shifted to longer wavelengths. So if you have a rough idea of what the spectrum should look like if it wasn't redshifted at all, then you can look at what the spectrum appears and you can estimate the redshift. So you're not doing it from a single spectral line, so it's not as precise, but it's still a crude estimate. So that was giving us a hint that the universe used to be decelerating and now is accelerating, but this was from about 2002, 2003. Much more recent data, including some of these, observed in 2004, 2005. Now, well, this is the one I showed before. Latest results still speeding up, but actually this compilation here only goes out to about redshift 1, where the universe had already done the switch over from decelerating to accelerating. So the really latest results, which is one I just presented at a meeting in Germany a few weeks ago, this is a compilation that goes quite a bit further out. There's not that many supernovae observed above redshift 1, but there's enough to make us pretty sure that the universe is following the curve in which you've got deceleration followed by acceleration, rather than it was just accelerating all the time. Now, there are some theoretical models, quite exotic ones, one called conformal gravity, that wouldn't do that. So again, we're just starting to get to the point where the data are good enough that you can test ideas and maybe rule some theories out, maybe favour some others. But it's early days, and what we would like to have is lots more supernovae at higher redshift, or maybe some other things that would tell us how this curve looks beyond the point where the supernovae run out. Now, you know, it's not as easy as just building a bigger telescope, because there might not actually be all that many supernovae happening at higher redshift, because the higher redshift you go to, the further back in time you're looking. And there might not have been enough time for the stars that formed prior to that to have reached the stage of becoming supernovae. So supernovae have been a wonderful addition to the cosmology's toolbox, but we're kind of limited in the range we can use them over. Yes, but even there, you would have issues probably with... that's a good point, but again, if you're seeing them at high redshift, then what would probably happen is that the Cepheids would be sufficiently redshifted that you'd be seeing them in the infrared.
Right.
So it would have to be a very, very, very large infrared telescope.
Right.
If you look at the proposals for future ground base, we saw some of these in the first few weeks, things like the Giant Magellan Telescope or the Extremely Large Telescope. They're looking in the near infrared, but it's perhaps not likely that they would be able to see... Well, first of all, they simply aren't big enough to see Cepheids at these kind of distances. But you know, they might get bigger in the future, but you've also got to consider what redshift range, what wavelength range you're looking at, so that the objects you're looking for are visible to you. So there are, you know, there are issues to be considered there. I mean, this affects the supernovae as well, because the spectrum, or what we call the light curve, which is just, you know, how much light is given off as a function of time for the supernova, that we see is going to be shifted towards longer wavelengths. So the further out the supernova is, then the more you're seeing the light that originally came from blue colours but has been shifted towards the red. So you have to think about you know, what filters you're going to use. But in the future, it's possible. I mean, to give you a handle on this, let's try and do the numbers here. A typical luminosity of a Cepheid, let me try and get this right, would be about -8, let's call it -10, that's close enough. The luminosity of a supernova is more like -20. So there's a different, rather not luminosity, absolute magnitude. We've touched on this once or twice, that this is the system that astronomers use. So a difference of 10 in absolute magnitude corresponds to 1,000 in luminosity. So you would expect to be able to see the Cepheids, you would expect the Cepheids to be about, sorry, let me back up, did I get that wrong? Let me see, so factor of 10, so it's 100, 10,000, factor of 10,000 in luminosity. So the Cepheids would be about 10,000 times fainter. Therefore, you would need a telescope that was about 100 times bigger in aperture, so that its area was 10,000 times bigger, in order to be able to see the Cepheids as far out as we currently see the supernovae. So say the Hubble telescope's about 2 metres in aperture, or best ground based is about 10 metres, so it would need to be a kilometre across. That's the kind of size you would need. So the overwhelmingly large telescope was 100 metres, so I don't know what we would call a kilometre size one. But probably in a few generations, that's the size we'll be looking for. Say from the dark side of the moon, there are already ideas, you know, to put very large optical and radio telescopes on the dark side of the moon. So, you know, it's a fair point, but I think we have to look further down. Yeah, hard to do in practice. So there are other things you could use as distance indicators, as standard candles. It wouldn't have to be Cepheids. And indeed, one of the ones that I work on is gravitational wave sources. Now, we haven't detected any gravitational waves yet, so again, one shouldn't get ahead of oneself. But the hope is that when a mission called LISA flies in about 10 years' time, which is a space-borne gravitational wave observatory, that it will be able to detect merging supermassive black holes up to redshift 3 or 4 or even 5, and should be able to determine very high precision distances to them. Again, that's way beyond the scope of the course, but that's where we're looking to fill in the gap left by there not being sufficient numbers of supernovae to give us distance probes further out. And, you know, in the fullness of time, we might be able to do things like that with Cepheids as well, but certainly not within my lifetime. Okay, let me keep an eye on the time here. I've put in some slides on the microwave background. I think it would be only fair to cover it, but at the same time, this is a bit removed from discussion of the Hubble telescope. But let me just see how we do. Can I just see if there's any other questions, first of all, though, before we move on? Okay. Let's see, ask away if things occur to you. But really, it would be remiss to do any talk in cosmology without mention of the microwave background these days, because it's become so important. As I tried to stress 2 weeks ago, the Hubble telescope observations of things like Cepheids still play a role here, and I'll try to just re-emphasise that point briefly in a few minutes. But the microwave background has given us a view of the universe in its very earliest moments, well, relatively speaking, 400,000 years or so after the Big Bang, which is a lot smaller than 13.7 billion years after the Big Bang. And I mentioned 2 weeks ago that it's a bit like looking into a fog. The idea being that the light coming to us from the early universe was scattered a lot because the universe was hotter and denser, and it was full of ionized hydrogen. Ionized meaning that the nucleus of hydrogen, the proton, was separated from the electron because it was too hot for the electron to be contained within a neutral atom. Therefore, the electrons are very good at scattering light, just like the air molecules are good at scattering the headlights in a fog. But after about 380,000 years, the universe had cooled down enough that neutral hydrogen could exist. So instead of all these free electrons, just shown in cartoon form as the little purple circles, which were very good at scattering light, instead of them being around, what you had instead was neutral hydrogen atoms, which aren't very good at scattering light. So the light could then just more or less go in a straight line, or follow the natural path that it would do in an undisturbed fashion. And therefore, that's like looking at the edge of a fog bank. You're seeing the universe as it was as the fog cleared. So what do we see? Well, This radiation was first of all discovered in the 1960s by Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson. It had been predicted theoretically by various people before, George Gamow, Robert Dickey, Jim Peebles, who were taking the view that if there was a Big Bang and the universe used to be very hot, then there must have been a time when it was so hot that the gas would have been ionised in this manner, and therefore that light would have been scattered. Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson were not astronomers, they were working for Bell Laboratories on the design of highly sensitive radio antennae, and in trying to build one, what they found was that there was a lot of background interference. And that background interference manifested itself as a map like this one. So this is how bright, in radio terms, the interference was all around the sky. There seemed to be quite a lot of it coming from the plane of our galaxy, but there was also a background that was pretty much the same everywhere, and they didn't know what it was. They deduced what it was in conversation with Jim Peebles and Robert Dickey, who said, what you've found is the cosmic background radiation, the radiation that's left over from the Big Bang as it cooled down and eventually became cool enough that the universe became neutral. So you're seeing the light streaming towards us from that time because it wasn't being scattered by the fog anymore, to continue the metaphor. Fast forward 20 years or so, 24 years, and in 1989, this spacecraft was launched called COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer. And its job was to measure how bright that background radiation was in different directions and to see whether it really was the case that it was the same temperature everywhere, the same brightness everywhere. Turned out it wasn't. What COBE saw, again, was a big signal coming from our galaxy. That's all foreground stuff, stars and nebulae in the plane of our galaxy. But if you subtract that off, then what you had left behind, well, I thought I had a picture of it here, but it must be coming up in a minute, is kind of all the stuff that you see at the top and the bottom of this diagram, the blues and the purples and the greens and the blacks. The different colours indicate different temperatures, so you're looking at a field of radiation coming towards us from all directions. It's not got exactly the same temperature, but the variations here are down at the level of about 1/100,000th of a degree. So it was a very, very sensitive measurement that COBE was able to make. And then in 2001, another space probe called the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe was launched, or WMAP, as it's known. And WMAP made an even more accurate map of the temperature as a function of direction. And here's what it saw. So again, it sees a big foreground from our galaxy. But if you can work out what that foreground is, subtract it off, and see what you're left with, then you get this pattern of temperature variations, which are very fine, that they're variations on small angles on the sky. So what's the difference between this one and this one? Well, it's about a little bit like what happens if I look at you and take my glasses off. So that's the blurry version, which is like the middle one, because COBE could only measure the temperature within a few degrees in the sky, so it's all very blurred out. If I put my glasses back on, you come into sharp focus, and that's really what WMAP was able to do. So its first results were reported in 2003, most recent results were reported in 2008, which really just extend the same story. And here's the cleaned up COBE map with the foreground contamination from our galaxy removed, so again the blurred one, and then the much sharper one we'll see in a moment. But already what COBE showed, well, just go back to the big version first, was that there really was a clear signature of variations in temperature with direction. The universe was not completely smooth back then, i.e. it didn't have the same temperature everywhere. It had lumpy bits. The lumpier bits were where the universe was a wee bit colder and denser. The hot parts, it was warmer and more rarefied. And the basic picture, which cosmologists developed, really, we'd been waiting to detect this because our picture said that the universe had to be lumpy back then, at a tiny amount, non-uniform, so that over the course of the billions of years since that radiation was emitted, the lumps would grow and become the galaxies and clusters of galaxies that we see today. So what you were getting an insight on was the recipe that existed back in the early universe, you know, how much of the different constituents of the universe, in order to make galaxies today in order to make the structure that we see in the universe today. Now, we have a fancy word for this. We call it the power spectrum. But it's essentially a description, like a recipe, of how this pattern of temperature variations is spread across the sky, how you see bright patches and not so bright patches. But again, this is like having a recipe that you can't read very well because it's a bit out of focus or a bit blurred. So what WMAP did was give us a much sharper picture from which we could deduce much more precisely what the ingredients of the universe were back then and see if they made sense compared with what we see now. So this power spectrum that I mentioned allows us to measure the size of the typical variations in temperature. And theory would let us predict what that distribution of variations in size ought to be. And for example, if you remember the little ants the other week, we described a simple model of the universe just in a tennis ball or a saddle shape or a flat piece of paper in which the universe has different curvatures. So we talked about being able to deduce that curvature from the light path followed by light coming from a distant supernova, but you can also do the same sort of thing looking at the light from the microwave background. So you can try to match up the pattern of temperature variations that you see with what you would expect to see if the universe was either an open geometry, like a saddle shape, a flat geometry, like a flat piece of paper, or a closed geometry, like a tennis ball. The way that you describe that in a graph is this one. It's a very famous one, so you don't worry too much about the details. But have a look at these numbers at the top. This is the angular scale. It's the size of the variations in temperature. So if you look at the big one first, we'll go back to the graph in a minute, you can see that there are temperature variations, again, as I said, at the level of a few hundred thousandths of a degree, really small, but they are there, that if you pick a patch in the sky and say, right, what's the typical temperature of a patch that's separated from that one by 1 degree? So what you then do is you go and find another bit that's 1 degree away and find its temperature, and then do that across the whole of the sky, average your results. That's really what you're doing when you make a power spectrum. And what you see here is little dots that represent the measurements that cosmologists made. And what you see is very, very faint, but there's a kind of blue line there, which is the theoretical prediction of where the measurements ought to be for a particular model of the universe with a certain amount of dark matter and a certain amount of dark energy and a certain value for the Hubble constant. So you're really doing sort of precision cookery, in that you've got a theoretical model that attempts to predict. Certainly, Mark, sure.
So the that picture.
Yeah.
That's a 2D picture.
It is. Yeah.
So is that actually showing all the obviously we're inside the universe expanded. So is that
sort of? It's a 2D picture because the radiation is coming to us from a particular time. Okay, so it's coming to us from all directions, but at a particular time, and the assumption is that after the universe cooled down enough to become neutral, then the radiation won't get disturbed anymore, it won't get scattered anymore, so you're seeing an imprint of what it was like at that moment.
At the time when it all, sort of, all the atoms decided they were going to go neutral,
yeah.
all the photons then piled towards, or stopped going around, all the ones that came towards where we
came. Exactly, there'll be photons going off in other directions as well, but we don't get to see them, but we get to see the ones that were coming towards us. Yeah, exactly. Now, I mean, as you say, it's very easy to have anthropomorphised this. You see the protons all decided to become neutral. But in a sense, that is really how it happened. It was a fairly abrupt moment because the universe had an almost exactly uniform temperature. And as the temperature cools, then the rate at which atoms, you know, combined, or ions combined together to become neutral atoms, it will happen fairly suddenly. But we can also measure the kind of width and time over which it happens. It's quite narrow, so we generally talk about it all happening in an instant, but it wasn't really. But, you know, compared with the time scale of billions of years, it was effectively instantaneous. So that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a map of the sky. If you imagine wrapping that round your head, which, you know, it's hard enough to wrap the concepts round your head, never mind the graph itself, but that's kind of what you're seeing. because you're seeing this radiation coming to us from all directions. And as you quite rightly say, there would equally have been radiation going off in all other directions as well. We don't ever get to see that. And indeed, in fact, you know, that's an excellent question, and maybe it's worth mentioning something. You know, this is a rather subtle point, as they don't get bogged down in the details here, because it's all very far removed from our nice Hubble telescope pictures. But this is really where the data are in cosmology right now. The number of people that spend their lives poring over these kind of graphs, you know, far outnumbers the folks that look at Hubble telescope images. That's just the reality. HST is still important, but so are these observations in other parts of the spectrum, other types of observations. And notice there's this kind of pinky colour here. What that pink colour denotes is the kind of range of our best guess as to what the data are. So, you know, the best fitting theory is this very faint line you can barely see, which matches the data extremely well, but there's a little bit of wriggle room, and that's what the pink curve is supposed to represent. And there's a lot of wriggle room down here. Now, the reason for that is that there you're talking about angular scales which are really rather large, 90 degrees. So you're imagining taking a patch of the sky and then saying, okay, let's take a wee patch about a degree across, and let's compare that with another patch that's 90 degrees away from it. Well, you've not got so many of them. And this is a fundamental limitation, because we're seeing the universe from just one place. If what we could do is, we could magically transport ourselves to another part of the universe and see what it looked like when we look at the micro, then we'd see some of those photons that were going off in other directions, and it would give us more information. But we can't. So we're stuck with this. We call this a cosmic variance problem. It's essentially because we can't look at variations in the universe from anywhere other than where we are. But nonetheless, the agreement with theory is extremely good, and, you know, as I say, it's very far removed from the pretty Hubble telescope pictures, but it is very fundamental to our sort of understanding of why we think the universe is speeding up. Those are different experiments. So there's WMAP, Akbar, if you're a Star Wars fan, Admiral Akbar was a character in The Return of the Jedi, so it is, indeed. There's a long history of Star Wars influences in cosmology. Another form of dark energy, which is a slightly more exotic version, which nobody really believes, but theoretically we haven't been able to rule it out yet, is called phantom energy, and that's really got as much to do with the fact that the idea was proposed in 1999 when The Phantom Menace came out. It kind of has, yes, so I'll maybe use that line in future, so that's a good comment. And indeed, one of the proposed future missions to observe more redshifts for supernovae out beyond the range that we've seen so far, if I just quickly go back to my diagram, is called the Joint Dark Energy Mission, or JDEM, but the original acronym for that was JEDI, so you can kind of see where we've all been influenced in our formative years. So yeah, so that's the situation. See, I didn't want to devote too much time to the CMBR, but it wouldn't have been fair to ignore it completely. So these are other experiments. Actually, some of them are at the south pole of the Earth, because microwaves, we're talking about, you know, radio waves basically, they can get through our atmosphere rather better, and they're contaminated less by radionuclide and the like if you go to somewhere like the South Pole. So we have a former graduate student that did a master's with us and then went to work in Berkeley to do his PhD. And he actually, you know, everybody thought, wow, going to Berkeley, that's great. But he spent about 2 years out of four at the South Pole. So wasn't quite as much fun as you may suggest. But these are CBI's Cosmic Background Imager, not Confederation of British Industries. VSA, Very Small Array, which is, again, just an array of sort of essentially radio telescopes or microwave dishes trying to measure the microwave background. There's another mission that's going to be launched later this year called Planck, named after Max Planck, the Planck Explorer, which will measure the microwave background to even greater precision than the WMAP results. So it's essentially like the high definition version, you know, we'll go even better in terms of the size of those little pixels. So that's where it's all headed. So what does all of this, so we'll bring it now back to the Hubble telescope stuff. The summary basically is that from the WMAP data, we think that the universe has got a flat geometry. And part of the reason why, to just briefly go back to a previous slide, if you imagine zooming in on a tiny part of this curved surface, it would look flat. So the observations of WMAP, they don't prove that something called inflation happened in the early universe, but they're consistent with the idea that the universe underwent very rapid expansion in a tiny fraction of a second after the Big Bang, which means that the bit of the universe that we actually see is just a tiny bit of this surface. So maybe the curvature of the universe is actually closed if you could see the whole universe, but we only see a tiny bit, so it looks flat to us. A few of you might have made it along to a talk I did for the Royal Philosophical Society. My apologies, I really meant to let you know in advance, you know, again, not that you had to go or anything, but I figured that many people might be interested, which I called Why Are We Here? And it was looking at theories of the multiverse, the idea that there might be more universes out there. It was very much on the kind of fringes of science, really, but interesting all the same. And they're tied up with this notion of inflation, that maybe the universe underwent very rapid expansion in the very earliest moments. So the Hubble telescope really doesn't probe any of that stuff. But what it does do is give us a reliable determination of the present expansion rate of the universe, the Hubble constant that we saw in the earlier graph. This one. And as you can see, the values have settled down to about 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec. The Hubble telescope played a very important part in that, and that really has helped us to squeeze more information out of the WMAP data. It relates to that point I was making about the width of these pink lines. That's on big angular scales where we are affected by the fact that we can't observe the universe very well on those big angular scales because we only see it from one place. Now, what the Hubble telescope has done is helped to provide an independent check for what the vertical position of the theoretical curve ought to be by measuring the local value of the Hubble constant. So that essentially means that if you just try to constrain the properties of the universe using the WMAP data alone, you do pretty well because it's amazingly good data, but you do even better still if you combine it with the Hubble telescope determination of the Hubble constant. So there's a real role for joining together and merging these data sets. So actually, the best combination of all is the WMAP data, distant supernovae, the nearby determination of the Hubble constant from Cepheids, and a whole different method altogether called baryon acoustic oscillations, which there just isn't time, I'm afraid, to go into. But that's to do with big surveys of galaxies, hundreds of thousands of galaxies across big volumes of space. And that's the next topic that we're going to move on to. Hubble hasn't contributed all that much to that, but it has a bit. And certainly Hubble's had a lot to do with our understanding of how galaxies evolved and formed. So, with apologies for doing it in such a great rush, we're going to leave the microwave background behind now, but we're going to say that at least our best guess at the moment is that we think the universe will continue to expand forever. We think the expansion's accelerating, as we learned about a couple of weeks ago. What's the future of the universe? Well, if all of what I've said in the previous slide is correct, then it means there's not going to be a big crunch. The universe will not recollapse again. There isn't enough matter to pull it all back together. And on the contrary, the dark energy, okay, we don't really understand it, but we think the effect it's having is to push things apart even faster. So maybe the dark energy will change into something else, which might then, in the future, be able to pull the universe back together. But we don't have any evidence for that yet.
Are we of this idea of dark energy?
Well, we're really not, but the thing we're very confident of is that the universe is accelerating. I mean,
could it be that it's not so much dark energy, but just on that scale, energy is not conserved?
Well, possibly. But that's a big thing to... I mean, the way in which we make progress in any scientific endeavour like this, I guess, is to develop a hypothesis like that and then think of a way to test it. So if we could think of a way to test whether energy is being conserved, then you're in business. But essentially the difficulty is, because all of these things are so far away, it's not like experimental or laboratory science where you can think, right, I wonder what will happen if I do this. and then you can sort of test things like, you know, is energy conserved? You can try doing the experiment a different way. We're very much constrained because we just get what the universe gives us. So there's no doubt that that, you know, remains, at least at some level, a possibility, or some of the theories that have been proposed as alternatives to dark energy might involve violating some of the, you know, the basic rules that we think apply. The real challenge for me is, well, how do you test them? So the thing that I usually say, and, you know, have done throughout the last few years that I've been doing talks for DACE and for the wider public, is that I'm very confident, based on the current data, that we have firm evidence that the universe is accelerating, but we just don't really know why. We call the reason why dark energy, but we know so little about what dark energy really is that it would be rather big-headed of us to say that we've answered that particular question. All the astronomers can do is measure what we think the universe is doing, and explaining why is a whole other story. But okay, so where does this leave us? Well, if we go back to that slide we had before, the basic picture is the universe used to be almost completely smooth, but the tiny ripples that we see in the microwave background evolved into the galaxies that we see today because they grew under gravity. So that's the kind of final topic that we want to cover, is to explore these ideas about how galaxies formed and grew. So let me, we're doing pretty well for time. Let me first of all show you a movie. This is a fake universe, which is maybe a slightly disparaging way to put it. It's a simulation, not the real universe, but it's a simulation of the distribution of matter, and the different colours represent the density of matter. You can see that it's very stringy, it's almost a bit like spaghetti. And this was done by the Institute for Computational Cosmology in Durham, people whom I know very well, although I've not worked directly with them on this. It's a really superb group of cosmologists who've devoted pretty much the last 10 years to trying to simulate the universe in ever bigger and bigger computer simulations, and what you see is what they see in the final analysis ought to be a galaxy, or actually in this case a particular simulation, because it's so big. On the smallest scale we're going to be looking at actually a whole number of galaxies. So if you look seven, well, let's just wait till it stops and then I'll talk about what we're seeing. The distance, it's going to zoom back out again. The distance between us and the Andromeda galaxy is about a megaparsec, about a couple of million light years, a bit less than a megaparsec. So that final box that we were looking at in there was comparable in size to our local patch of the universe that contains a few big galaxies and lots of smaller ones. So that's roughly speaking what you were looking at. So this is work that's been done in collaboration between Durham University and the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics in Garching in Germany. And notice what you're seeing as you zoom in is ever smaller scales, and yet even on the very smallest scales there's still structure there. You can see the galaxies, but there's other stuff as well. Because what this really represents is the dark matter. Again, rather embarrassing, we don't really know what that is either, but what we know is that galaxies, we believe at least, are surrounded by this dark matter. So, although you see bright lights here, it's not really fair to say that each one of those is a galaxy. What the brightness indicates is regions where there's a lot of dark matter. Now, it's probable that you'll also get galaxies forming where there's a lot of dark matter around, but it doesn't necessarily follow. So there's a fundamental issue that makes it quite hard to go from your computer simulations to the real universe. The computer simulations model all of the matter, the luminous stuff and the dark, but actually mainly the dark because there's more of it, we think, whereas a survey of galaxies just shows you where the luminous matter is. So how do you know that the two match up? So to let you see that in essence, and those of you that did make it to the Galaxies Day will recognise a few of these slides perhaps. Here is a survey of galaxies. So each black dot here represents the position of a galaxy. So it's a wedge shape. Now, I'll go back to this one in a moment, but to let you see how this would be constructed, there's us in the centre, we look at galaxies all around us, and we make a kind of a wedge diagram and plot the position of every galaxy inside it that we see. So there's a distance along the wedge and then a sort of angle round, and it's got a certain width, but we just fold it down so that all the galaxies are sitting on top of each other. And that's what you see. So what you see is that the galaxies are not spread uniformly out. Now this is a very old one. This was done in the early 80s, and this was the best we could do back then. So you see patterns. This came to be known colloquially as the Harvard stick man, because it does look a little bit like a stick figure. Again, I don't think there's any deep cosmic significance in that. It was done by astronomers at the Centre for Astrophysics in Harvard. So you're going out a few 100 megaparsecs, but as you get to the edge, that's a few hundred million light years, the galaxies seem to fade out. Now we don't think it's really that there aren't any there, it's just that they were too faint to be observed. But down here on the other hand, we think that there aren't any galaxies really in that bit of the universe. Now there might still be a lot of dark matter around, but for some reason it never turned into galaxies. So the challenge for understanding how galaxies formed is not only what kinds of galaxies form, but why do some form in some places and not in others? Why do you get galaxies forming in rich clusters, whereas in other bits of the universe, galaxies seem to wind up being spread out along thin filaments? And indeed in other regions you get none at all. We call those voids. Now this pattern has been repeated as we've made bigger and bigger galaxy surveys, again not really with any contribution from the Hubble telescope, well first of all in this slide because it hadn't been launched yet, but even after it had been launched this wasn't something that Hubble really got directly involved in. This is real grunt work, it's not something you would want to use the Hubble for. What you want to do is use a ground based telescope that's capable night after night after night of looking around the sky and just basically making a survey of all the galaxies it sees. So here's one from the mid-80s, a bit later than the previous one. Now this phrase, fingers of God, was coined, essentially as you can see they all seem to be pointing into the middle. This is a distortion in your map, because in a cluster of galaxies they're not actually really expanding with the universe because they're held together by their own gravity. So the pattern of redshifts that we call Hubble's law gets distorted. Essentially, the galaxies in each cluster are basically here, where the blue arrow is, but there are some which are, if you imagine, in the foreground of that cluster, falling in towards the centre, and maybe falling in rather fast, so they wind up with a much higher apparent velocity than just due to the expansion of the universe. That means that they actually wind up in this plot over here. And then there are other ones which are in the back end of the cluster, which are falling back towards the centre of the cluster, so they wind up with a lower apparent recession speed than the cluster as a whole. So they wind up being the ones that you see here. So the cluster gets kind of stretched out in this way of looking at it. So that, if you want to not get too bothered by the details, think of it as just a kind of an optical illusion. It's not a real effect. It's just an effect of how we construct the survey. But there are other features which are real. We think they are anyway. You see galaxies spread out over a very large volume of space. You also see regions where there are effectively none. So this is from the mid-80s. Even later, into the mid-90s, the same kinds of features were being seen now over a much bigger scale. So the Harvard stick man that we saw before was now being replaced by bigger and bigger surveys that maybe went three or four times deeper into the universe. Still they fade out at the edge because you can see fainter galaxies, but there comes a point beyond which you just can't see them anymore. We still think they're there, but the important stuff is in here. You can see again more voids and more filaments and so on. So if we zoom in on that original Harvard stickman slice, and then if you look at the bigger surveys you see features which are not too dissimilar. So the size of the structures is kind of similar in both samples, so we seem to be getting to a point where we were sampling the biggest things that had had enough time to evolve and form since the Big Bang. And it was no longer the case, as had been the case in the early surveys, that the structures we were finding were almost as big as the survey itself, which might have made you think, oh well, maybe there's even bigger things that we haven't seen yet. So from about the mid-90s we began to think, yep, we're seeing the biggest things that have had enough time to form, structures like this Great Wall that we mentioned before. And then in the late 90s and the early years of this century, two further very large-scale projects came online. One called the 2-degree Field Galaxy Redshift Survey. So what it did was, it took as its input catalogue a map of the sky, just the projected positions, no redshifts, but it then went to look at a large sample of those galaxies, about 250,000 of them, and wanted to get redshifts for them so it could build up a three-dimensional map of where they were. And that was all done using a telescope in Australia. So nothing as fancy as Hubble, quite small, well, at least by today's standards, about 4 meters, so actually bigger than Hubble, but of course it's looking up through the atmosphere, so you can't really see so far. But what it had as a huge advantage was that it could be used night after night to do this. And it also had a very clever instrument. We talked in the early lectures in this course about what Hubble had. It had a spectrometer, it had a camera. Well, what the 2-degree field instrument was, as the name suggests, it was a field of view that's 2 degrees across. That's 4 times the width of the full moon. It's a big patch of sky that it could see all at once. And what it could do is it could record the redshifts of hundreds of different galaxies all at once using fibre optics. So the fibre optic would be positioned in the plane, the focal plane, the 2 degrees across focal plane, in just the right position to catch the light from a particular galaxy. And then that means you could do hundreds of redshifts all at once. You know, still a lot of work, mainly for poor graduate students that had to do all the grunt work down in Australia, but that's how we could accumulate as many as 250,000 redshifts in just a few years. And this is what it looked like as a sort of picture. Again, here's a slightly bigger view. This is just one slice through it. It shows 113,000 or so. Again, you see the same kind of structures, the filaments, the voids, the sheets, the clusters. And if you look at different patches, 100 megaparsecs, that's 300 million light years or so across, you're sampling a big chunk of the universe and you're seeing the same kind of structure and patterns repeated. An even more extensive survey is called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And this has been done by another fairly small camera at Apache Point in New Mexico. The telescope's a few metres across, the camera's got a big field of view, and what it's been able to do is observe roughly about 1 million galaxy redshifts. So there's part of the Sloan survey, there's the 2-degree field. They're both much bigger surveys than the old Harvard Stickman was in the 80s, so this has been a growth industry over the last 20 years. What has it told us? Well, it's allowed us to try to make some judgments as to what type of universe we live in. So we'll do this one just before we stop for the break. What you see here is a slice from the 2DF or 2-degree field galaxy redshift survey. And what you see here are 4 computer simulations which have made different assumptions about what sort of universe we live in, what recipe there was that explained the galaxy formation. Now those are indicated by the symbols. Again, the details needn't concern us. The point is, we're very good at this. We're good at pattern matching, so we're going to put that to the test. I'm going to get you guys to vote on which one you think is the best match, and then we'll explain a wee bit what is going on. So there's this one up here. Anyone vote for that one? What about that one? That one there?
Yeah.
That one there. Okay, so most people go for the lower left one. Right, let's explain what the symbol means. Lambda CDM, that's a universe with dark matter, actually cold dark matter, that's why it's CDM. That's a detail that needn't concern us. The lambda is the dark energy, that's the Greek letter that we assign to Einstein's so-called cosmological constant. SCDM is standard CDM. So basically what you're looking at is, this is a universe with no dark energy. this is a universe with dark energy. So in addition to the microwave background and the supernovae and all these other things we can use to try and tell us whether the dark energy models are correct, what you can also do is try and carry out a simulation modelling how the universe would evolve with and without dark energy and see which one gives a better match. But it's complicated, and that's where the other thing comes in. It says bias. Okay? Bias 1 and bias 2. That relates to the fact, like I said a few minutes ago, the computer simulation tells you where the dark matter is. It doesn't tell you where the galaxies will actually form. So what you have to do is to develop, in addition, a model that tells you, for a given amount of dark matter, how many galaxies you're going to get and where they will be and what sort of galaxies they will be. We call that a model for the galaxy biasing factor. And to be honest, it's a bit of a fudge factor. So it gives you a lot of wriggle room in matching. But the reality is that only certain types of bias factors work. And certainly, if you compare these two, so they've both got dark energy in them, but they've got different biasing that influences where the galaxies will actually form. Same amount of dark matter, same amount of dark energy, but a different prescription, a different recipe for how the galaxies form. And as you can see, at least qualitatively, you can see that that one is a better match to the observations than the top one. But, you know, it's a bit hokey. That's the difficulty of what in physics we would call having to forward model the problem. What we have to do is build a simulation of the early universe informed by what we see in the microwave background and then work it all out forwards 13.7 billion years. What we'd really like to do is to take this one, which is what we actually observe, and run the clock backwards and then come up with what the universe had to be like and then maybe compare that with the WMAP data. That's a lot harder to do, but that's kind of where the galaxy formation picture currently rests. On big scales, what we can do is we can make maps of how we think the universe ought to look on a computer and compare them with what we actually see. And I will just do one more slide. This is a process which will likely continue for the foreseeable future, because what you see here is a rough indication of how the things have evolved over time. In fact, the little Harvard Stickman doesn't even make it onto this because it was so long ago and so small. The number of objects was less than 1,000. But over the past 10 or 15 years, there's been a great growth in the volume of space that the surveys have sampled, and also the number of objects that we have redshifts for. And it's all with a view to trying to give us a better way to then compare with what our computer simulations tell us. But actually, these are all ground-based projects. So Hubble hasn't really played a role there. What Hubble has done, and we'll talk about that after the break in the final bit, Hubble has focused rather more on the one thing it can do that the other surveys can't do, which is to go deep. So instead of covering a big area of sky and making these big wedges of galaxies, but only to a fairly shallow depth, what Hubble has concentrated on is making small images of very, very distant galaxies, and then that means that you're looking further back in time. Okay? So, we'll pick up that story after the break. We'll compare the types of galaxies that we see today, which are, you know, the classification is named in honour of Edwin Hubble himself, because he kind of devised it, which has ellipticals and spirals, and we'll look at what the Hubble telescope, among other telescopes, has told us about how that picture came about and compare it with what the universe was like, to coin a phrase, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Okay, so if we stop there, maybe, well, that clock's no good to us, but I make it 8:33, about 10 to 9. If we could start again then, that would be good. Thanks very much. Right. Sure. Thanks for your email, by the way, that was very kind of you. Yeah.
About the geometry of the universe, you're saying it's flat, yet the kind of, again, the kind of concept of a big bang
Yep.
is a theoretical degree, and you could understand then, I think you used a the surface of a balloon.
Mm-hmm.
At one of the notches there. How does that square then?
Well, remember I mentioned the idea of inflation. If you're looking at just a tiny patch of the balloon, then it looks flat.
Right.
Okay, so ultimately we can't really say, but bear in mind another important thing is that the geometry I'm talking about here is just the spatial geometry. The analogy of the balloon really kind of only makes sense if you also introduce time, sort of as the balloon inflates, you've got that time dimension, you know, the balloon gets bigger. But we can see the curved surface of the balloon for sure, because we're big compared with the balloon, but if we were tiny, or the balloon was very big, then locally it would look flat to us. So that's kind of how we square it at the moment.
If you were to use that analogy of a balloon in relation, for example, to ourselves,
mm-hmm.
or the Milky Way, we'd be on that, we'd be on the surface of that balloon, and right
we
next
would.
To us would be, right next to us would be the Andromeda.
Andromeda, yeah. Uh-huh.
Would then, given that the Hubble has detected this tiny little point of light, which is 13 billion light years away,
mm-hmm.
would that point of light then almost be diagonally, in terms of a balloon, diagonally opposite?
Well, it really depends on whether there was inflation or not. I mean, it's entirely possible that it could be, and because if one of the things that people throughout the last 50 years have been seeking to answer is whether there's enough matter in the universe for it to re-collapse again.
Yes.
Now, if there were, then the geometry would basically correspond to the closed surface of the balloon.
Yes.
And then you could indeed imagine looking far enough back that you'd be kind of seeing round to the other side of the balloon. And in actual fact, you could wind up seeing a copy of yourself.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So, you know, so people have looked for that, and they don't see any evidence of it, which again backs up, it doesn't prove anything, but it's consistent with the idea that actually, if the universe had this inflationary expansion in its earliest moments, then it made the patch that we can see so small compared with the whole universe, that really we can't see anything about what lies beyond our immediate horizon. It's like only being able to see a tiny patch of that surface of the balloon. You've no idea if it's a spherical balloon or it's a, you know, sausage dog shape or, you know.
Would it then, in theory, be possible, if you can see back effectively 50 billion years, in theory, could you actually see the Big Bang?
Well, one has to be careful. You really can't see back 13 billion years. You can see back to the microwave background, which is 380,000 years after.
It's actually a genuine image, one little point of light.
No, not really. What you're seeing in that picture of the microwave background is light coming to us from all different directions,
yes.
from a universe which used to be smaller. Now that's, you know, I took years to really get any kind of sense of what that means. I mean, you know, I could understand it mathematically, but to have a sort of physical picture of it was very hard.
Right.
Think of a series of concentric circles.
Yes.
And like the balloon, you're just moving on the surface of the circle, which, because it's only 1D, actually means you're just going round the circumference of the circle.
Right.
So we're looking from the outermost circle,
yes.
and we're looking further and further in,
yes.
towards a smaller one.
Yes.
So basically the path that light will take, because as you put all those circles around each other, time is increasing,
right.
you know, circles get bigger. The path that light will take will be a spiral.
Okay.
So from our perspective on the outermost circle, we will see light coming towards us,
yes.
from one direction or from the other direction. There's only those two directions in our one-dimensional circle.
Right. Fair enough.
But if we follow the path of the light backwards in time, then eventually it will spiral inwards and it will hit that innermost circle that
yes.
corresponds to the microwave background.
Right,
because
right.
inside that circle, the light gets scattered.
Right.
Like I was talking about the fog. So you see the fog bank as one of those innermost circles. But it's not that there's a particular point in space where the Big Bang happens. Instead, there's a point in time
right.
where it happens. But it happens everywhere at
right.
that time.
Right. So let me ask you, the other thing that's been questioning you, if you take the image of Andromeda, as you can see with your
mm-hmm.
naked eye,
mm-hmm.
very good thing. And that Andromeda is two million
light years away. Yeah.
Right. So now the thing is, it's coming towards us apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Is this the 2 million light years? Is that real time? In the sense that at this today at this point in time, that galaxy is 2 million light years away from us. Because between us seeing that and today, over the last 2 million years, that galaxy has come much closer to us.
Not really. I mean, the point you make is well made, that the 2 million years refers to the separation when the light set off.
Yes.
But the Andromeda Galaxy, I forget the exact value, but it's coming towards us at something like a few hundred kilometres per second.
Yes.
It's actually going to take roughly about 5 billion years before it reaches us.
Right.
So in the time that the light has been travelling towards us, Andromeda hasn't got all that much closer.
Right.
But the point you make is a very good one and a very important one with regard to some of the really distant objects we're looking at.
Yes.
All the more so if, as we believe, the universe really is accelerating in its expansion, because it means that for the most distant supernovae and galaxies that we're looking at, we're making a statement about how far away they are in terms of the light travel time.
Yes.
So that's essentially how far away they were when the light set off.
Yes.
By the time the light has reached us, they're a lot further away now.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. And indeed, so much so that
in terms of real time, as we sit here today, that measure of distance may not be.
Well, it depends what you mean. I mean, you can define what you mean. I didn't want to overcomplicate things through this course. It depends what you mean by accurate. I mean, again, it's an important point you make, but the analyses that, you know, say I carry out, do take proper account of whether you're talking about the distance now or the distance when the light set off.
Right.
Or indeed, there's another way of doing it, which is to use something called the co-moving distance, which takes into account the intervening expansion.
Yes.
I mean, a good analogy there is to think of latitude and longitude on the Earth.
Right.
We can define the latitude and longitude of London, Glasgow, whatever. If you look at a point on the globe, a small globe on your desk, it's got the same latitude and longitude, but of course the actual physical separation is vastly different.
Right.
But that's really just a rescaling factor.
Right.
Similarly, you can apply a rescaling factor to take account of the expansion. You've got to be careful you do it properly, and we are. And again, I didn't want to, you know, overcomplicate matters in the course. But it's all about defining what you mean by the distance in a properly consistent way, in a way that recognises that distance is only part of the story, it's also the time at which the distance is made.
Right.
And that's a concept that's absolutely hardwired in relativity,
right,
that you need to define both the distance and the time to properly define the separation of two events.
Right.
Okay, so we just have to take account of that.
Speaking a little about light, something I don't understand. When we talk about this fog just after the
Yeah, sure.
And light energy coming out of it before the atoms and the molecules started to form properly, is that the same light as we see now? I mean, as we define now?
Well, yes it is. I mean, the microwave background that the WMAP satellite measures will be little packets of light energy, photons, which really have been unchanged since that time, with one notable exception. They've been reddened, they've been shifted towards redder wavelengths because the universe has expanded, and that will affect the light just as it affects anything else. And therefore, that's why we see them as microwave light now, because, this is detail I didn't go into, and you know, would have been nice if I'd had the time, I suppose. The type of radiation that we're talking about here is called black body radiation, and there's a relationship between the temperature of black body radiation and the peak of its wavelength. Like the black body radiation we get from the sun, it's not exactly black body, but it's very close, peaks in the visible, that's why one might say, you know, it's tied up with the fact that we've evolved here on Earth with eyes that are sensitive to those wavelengths, and that's because the surface temperature of the sun is about 5,800 degrees. A much hotter star like Rigel and Orion, the peak in its black body spectrum is actually in the ultraviolet, because it's hotter. Conversely, going in the other direction, the peak of the black body spectrum of the microwave background radiation is now only about 3 degrees above absolute zero. But back when that radiation was emitted, the peak was about 3,000 degrees Kelvin.
Yeah.
And it's been cooling down ever since. But otherwise, the light's been largely unaffected because there's been nothing to scatter it or absorb it. It's just come towards us.
Have I got time then now?
Yeah.
You like to mention further development themselves. This is interesting. The one star that you've actually been able to discern a ball.
Sure. Betelgeuse. Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of the development of technology, with a crystal ball, you're able to look ahead to 100
yeah.
years.
Sure.
But would the astronomers then be able to observe Betelgeuse in almost the same way as we currently observe the sun?
Oh dear, that's a hard one to answer. You see, the thing is, the short answer is no.
It's simply there's not enough data coming from it, is that the...
We just need to build too big a telescope to do it. And the other thing is, the bigger a telescope you build, the more problematic it becomes to combine the information from one side of your mirror and the other side.
Right.
Now, I briefly touched on some of these ideas early in the course, talked about adaptive optics, where you sort of adjust the shape of the mirror to take account of all of that.
Yeah.
But there is a limit to how much that can be applied. I mean, you know, Brendan's question was a good one. We talked about the possibility of maybe having telescope mirrors a kilometre across.
Yeah.
What that would actually be is a whole bunch of individual mirrors
right.
that are just being shaped to image what you see. So I think, I mean, Betelgeuse is just so much further away. I forget the exact number. It's something like 600 light years.
Yeah.
Now there's, oh, so let's do it in parsecs. I think easier in parsecs. 200 parsecs. So it's about 200,000 times 200, 4 million. It's about 40 million times further away than the sun is.
Right.
So again, you know, let's say we imagine you can get a pretty good image of the sun with your eye.
Yeah.
You shouldn't look at it directly, but you know, you can see filtered. Indeed, you know, you can see that it's a that you can see perfectly well that it's a disk. So that's the kind of limit. You know, 8 millimeter diameter times 40 million would be the size you would need to get that same size of image of Betelgeuse. I mean, as you recall, I mean, I'm being very rough in my calculations, but just to give you some idea of what you know the scale of this is. The images that we have of Betelgeuse are not as detailed as the images we have of the sun, but it's a start. You know, we can at least discern a disk and we can tell that it's not uniform in temperature. But to get the same quality of data as we currently could get for the sun. But for more nearby stars, it's a bit more feasible because, you know, Betelgeuse is 600 light years away. It's also very big, which helps. But you've got stars like Alpha Centauri, which are only 4 light years away, and imaging them is a bit more feasible. Okay, is everyone back? Good. Well, right, so the final push towards conclusion. Say, I hope you've enjoyed the course overall. I hope some of you can make it next Monday, but what I want to do for those who can't is just try to at least reach the end of the current story of Hubble's contribution to galaxies and then link into where we go from there. Brendan mentioned earlier the next big mission is the James Webb Space Telescope, so I've got a slide at the end about that. So what we see here is known as Hubble's tuning fork classification. So you see ellipticals denoted by the E's and spirals denoted by the S's. And spirals come in two groups as well. You've got regular spirals and you've got barred spirals, which you can see fairly graphically there. There's this kind of handle sticking out of the centre of that spiral. An SA is a galaxy that's got quite a big central core and rather tightly wound spiral arms, whereas an SC has got a much smaller core and more open spiral arms. An elliptical galaxy, if you go from E0 to E7, all that means is it becomes more flattened. An E0 is basically a big spherical cloud of stars, and E7 is more flattened, a bit more like a rugby ball in dimensions. So Hubble never intended this to be any kind of grand plan of how galaxies change from one type to another. It was just a convenient way to classify them. Oh, sorry folks, I've only just started. I didn't realise there was still folks away. But I suppose it's fair to say that over the development of cosmology through the 20th century, sort of urban myth sprung up, which said that spirals evolved from ellipticals. So ellipticals were often known as early type galaxies and spirals as late type. But that turns out not to be true. And indeed it was never Hubble's intention that that should be the belief. So how has the Hubble Space Telescope helped us to make sense of what's really going on? Well, as you might expect, it's because by looking further and further away, you can look further back in time. So here's quite an early Hubble Space Telescope image. This is one which shows a modern day image of an elliptical in a spiral, and then it shows 5 billion light years or so away, when the universe was only about 9 billion years old, an elliptical and a couple of spirals. And then you go back a further 4 billion years, so that's you're going back 9 billion light years when the universe was only about 5 billion years old, and you can see, well, they start to look increasingly just like little smudges. Very hard to tell. So say this is an early Hubble image. So early on, because of all the problems that we talked about in the first week or so with the mirror, it was actually quite hard to do this. The further away you looked, the more pixelated the images became. It was really quite hard to tell what was going on. There were some clues that emerged. In particular, it began to become clear that the spirals very far away looked a bit kind of complex. Like, see there, the spiral arm's got a kind of knot in it. But it would take more time and much better images to really nail what was going on. So I remember doing public talks in about 95, 96, using this slide, and to be honest, it wasn't really all that convincing. But it wasn't too long thereafter where much better data was available that could show the evolution more clearly. So let's talk about what we now believe. The first feature to mention goes by the rather grand name of morphological segregation. What this means is that spirals are rarely found in rich clusters of galaxies these days. And the reason we think this is because spiral galaxies are really quite delicate structures. They've got these beautiful disks, which Hubble has imaged, like many other telescopes have imaged. And if you put one of those in a rich cluster, then the gravitational pull of all the other galaxies in the cluster is rather severe. In particular, what you get is tidal forces, which will tear the disk of the galaxy apart. Now, what helps to convince us that this is really what's going on? Well, here's WISPIC 2, so that was after the repair mission. So already you could start to do this rather better. Again, the images still look a bit patchy, but here's a very distant galaxy cluster. So what you're seeing here, three of them actually, is that in a distant galaxy cluster, you do see signs of galaxies with disks. That's because you're seeing a snapshot of them as they were when the galaxy was fairly newly formed. Now what we can't do, but would like to, is to actually watch that galaxy and that cluster evolve. But we don't get to see that, we just get to see a snapshot. But what we don't see in nearby galaxy clusters is the same kind of spiral structures, which makes us deduce that what must have happened to these spiral galaxies in distant clusters is that the disks didn't survive. Moreover, what we think may well have happened is that the disks, in getting disrupted, would wind up the material in the disk sort of falling in towards the centre of the cluster where the gravitational attraction would draw them. And what you would build up in the centre of a galaxy cluster is a very big elliptical galaxy, a giant elliptical. There's a good example of this in the nearby Virgo cluster. It's called M87, a very famous elliptical galaxy. We'll see images of that shortly. So, many ellipticals in clusters, which are still existing today, may well have formed from galaxy mergers, the mergers indeed of maybe the remnants of spirals that got torn apart because the tidal forces in clusters were too strong. So mergers is a key to understanding how galaxies form. And what the Hubble telescope, if I now jump forward to a much more modern image with the advanced camera, has shown is that there are hundreds of examples of merging and interacting galaxies. You don't actually get to see the merger happen because you're just seeing a snapshot of it. You're seeing one instant in the process of the merger. But it seems very, very clear that that's what's going on. You see all sorts of unusual and irregular shapes, which are galaxies which are in the process of undergoing a merger event. Now that's entirely consistent with what we see in our computer simulations. Maybe you didn't quite see that, you know, the simulation of the Millennium simulation that we ran before isn't the best one to illustrate it, but there are many others that have been carried out where you see fragments of galaxies merging and eventually forming bigger structures. But we don't need simulations, we can look at lots of beautiful Hubble telescope examples. This is one called the Antenna Nebula, and it shows two interacting galaxies where the nature of their interaction has kind of drawn out these long tails of stars behind gas and dust. And what you see with Hubble is a much more zoomed in view, sufficiently good that you can pick out regions where there are newly born stars forming. So the interaction of the two galaxies can trigger a burst of star formation within the galaxies. Here's another one. This is a sequence of images. This is the Hubble telescope one, but we can also see it in different sorts of light, ultraviolet light. So the newly born stars are quite prominent in ultraviolet because many of them are very hot. Now they have to be fairly newly born because hot stars don't last for very long. So that's why you see them so prominently in the ultraviolet. You also see the whole galaxy quite bright in infrared because it glows. That's infrared light from the glowing dust. So there's a lot of dust around, sort of hydrogen gas, which is the raw material out of which stars would form. In the visible, you see the glowing stars. You see the red light, which is called emission nebula, and that's nebulosity from glowing hydrogen gas. A particular spectral line called hydrogen alpha, which produces that red colour. And you see in many images, with Hubble and other ground-based telescopes, these red colours. And here's another example of it. This is a ground-based image of the galaxy NGC 4314. This is a Hubble telescope image from 98 with WIFPIC 2. And you can see the blue light coming from newly born hot young stars that have just been born, because essentially, as this galaxy, we think, has undergone some kind of interaction with a neighbour, then it's compressed the gas in certain regions of the galaxy to a sufficient extent that new stars can start to form. And you also see the red light coming from the ionised hydrogen gas, which is being ionised by ultraviolet light coming from those newly born stars.
I may have asked a question last, but sure.
No, you haven't asked that before. That's an excellent question. I haven't, if you bear with me again, no, but we're okay because it's not even 9 o'clock yet. Let me just quickly go to where I can provide a more complete answer, which I think is in here. So this is from my undergraduate lecture course on galaxies, so I certainly don't want to show you too much of that, but here's the relevant slide. This is a very simple computer model. This is actually rather old now, but I think it's still quite instructive. John Toomrey in the late 1970s started to try to model galaxies with just a handful of stars, but he tried to see what would happen if you had a head-on collision between a galaxy and another galaxy represented just by this sort of compact point here. And, okay, I don't have time to go through the details, but it's all to do with an idea called the Virial Theorem, which is to do with a system conserving its energy and its momentum, that what basically happens as the collision takes place is that it will produce a ring of material around where the collision happens. So to come back to your question then, we look at where the star formation has occurred in a ring. Well, that's probably happened in the fairly recent past, maybe the last few tens of millions of years. It's probably been caused by a head-on collision between that galaxy and another one, or maybe even the other one has been absorbed, you know, merged with the core of this one. But we just see the signature of it now in the ring of star formation. It underlines the difficulty of doing all this when we can't actually see the whole history of the event. We just see the aftermath. So it's, you know, it's like CSI cosmology, as I mentioned the other week. CSI galaxy formation. But that's what we think is going on. And there's many beautiful examples. This one's called the Cartwheel Nebula. No, the Pinwheel Nebula, I'm sorry. Where again you see a ring of gas that's probably been produced as an outflow from a head-on collision between that galaxy and a neighbour. And then here's another one, a polar ring around this galaxy. So that's all the equations that explain how it happens. If anyone's interested, it's to do with conserving the energy, but I say that's what our students get to cover. So what else can we... Actually, let me just see if this movie works, because I had meant to put this movie into... I must have moved it into a different directory, sorry. I'll put some movies on the website anyway, just so you can download them and have a look. So, what this suggests is that the process of the galaxy forming is related to the stars in the galaxy and how they form. So, you've got big scale effects like mergers of whole galaxies, which can trigger small scale effects like the creation of a new generation of stars. So we call a galaxy like this one a starburst galaxy because it's undergone a very sudden new burst of star formation. And a starburst galaxy often will be seen to be very luminous even if it's very far away. This is a fairly nearby one, but we can see starburst galaxies very far away. And we also see other sorts of galaxies very, very luminous indeed, even if they're extremely distant. And we call those active galaxies, or active galactic nuclei, otherwise known as quasars. Quasi-stellar objects is where the name quasar comes from. These were first observed in the 60s and 70s. They were very bright and they were really small. So for all we knew, they could have been stars. But the weird thing was, many of them had very high redshifts, so they seemed to be very far away. And gradually a picture emerged of explaining what they were, and that's just what we're going to briefly discuss now. But the Hubble Space Telescope played a very important part in helping to confirm that that picture was correct. The picture that emerged was that these were the cores of young galaxies. But what Hubble allowed us to do for the first time, really, was to see the rest of the galaxy, which ground-based observations hadn't been good enough to reveal, because all you see is the bright bit in the middle. But with Hubble, you could make out that this bright core was sitting inside just a kind of regular galaxy, except not quite regular, because sometimes the galaxy was interacting with a neighbour, which maybe suggested that the bright emission from the centre was somehow associated with the galaxy as a whole undergoing one of these merger events. Now here's a little movie suggesting what we think the core of an active galactic nucleus might look like. If you zoom all the way into the centre, then what we think is lurking there at the centre is a supermassive black hole. Now because this is just the final session, there isn't really time to do this justice, but let me just give you at least a flavour of why we think these are supermassive black holes. HST played a part, but there's other contributions from many other types of telescope and many other types of observation. First of all, here's the HST bit. If it is a supermassive black hole, what we think is going on is that it's surrounded by a disk of dust and gas that we call an accretion disk. And essentially, think of water spiraling down a plug hole. As material flows down towards the central supermassive black hole, then it forms this disk. And as stuff gets accelerated towards the disk, it will glow very brightly, not in the visible, partly in the visible, but also in X-rays and ultraviolet and gamma rays. And this thing will have a very strong magnetic field, which can cause particles to be fired along jets, which is what, this is just an artist's impression, but this is sort of roughly what we think is going on. Really bizarre object. And they say right in the centre you've got this supermassive black hole. So why do we think any of this is really there? Well, here's a few things. Here's a Hubble telescope image of M87. This is a giant elliptical in the core of the Virgo cluster. So that elliptical galaxy we think may well have formed out of the mergers of lots of spirals back in the distant past. We can't see that happen, but we just see the aftermath. And those merger events, where they were most concentrated in the centre, you had so much mass in a small volume that it created a supermassive black hole. And then what you see is jets of material, one moving away from us, which is the red one, and one moving towards us, which is the blue one. And the emission from those jets is redshifted. So what you see here, it's just a cartoon, but this is the spectrum. One is redshifted, one is blue-shifted. So that's just like, this is a cartoon as well, even more of a cartoon because there's no real data in there at all, but this is just an artist's impression of what we think is going on. We've got this jet of material coming towards and one going away. Well, that's what we see for M87. Even better, for some supermassive black holes, you can actually see the disk of material around them. Yep, sure.
How supermassive is supermassive?
About a million times the mass of the Sun. Well, we'll see a bit more on that in just a moment. The most massive is up to about 18 billion times the mass of the Sun. Most massive that's been observed. Tell me, Heather. Well, it's an excellent question. I mean, again, I just wish there was a bit more time. Let me try and give you an honest but fairly brief answer. What would make a black hole in the first place is if you could take any object, no matter how massive, and squash it down so that effectively the escape speed from that object was equal to the speed of light. Technically, you're supposed to use general relativity to work all that out, but actually the answer you get is the same. And it tells you that the size at which that would happen is what we call the Schwarzschild radius, or the event horizon of the black hole. Now, event horizon is a term that kind of entered our popular consciousness. In fact, I had the chance to visit the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles last week, and they've got a sort of a theatre for showing public presentations, and they call it the Leonard Nimoy Event Horizon Theatre. And so you can see where they got their sponsorship from. But the concept of event horizon has got a very precise mathematical definition, and it's got nothing to do with films involving Sam Neill from some years ago, if anyone saw that one. But the event horizon is the point beyond which even light couldn't escape. So to come to your question, if you consider taking the Sun and squashing it down to be so dense that the escape speed became equal to the speed of light, you'd have to squash it down to be only 3 kilometres across. So if you've got a 1 million times the mass of the Sun black hole, then its Schwarzschild radius or event horizon would be 3 million kilometres. Okay? Now here, 3 million kilometres is a big number, but compared with 400 light years, it's actually pretty tiny. So the supermassive black hole is way, 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 way down there in the innermost pixel of the HST image. So we are not seeing the supermassive black hole, but what we're seeing is the ring of material around it. Now, how do we know it's a black hole? Well, I suppose we don't really, but what we can deduce is, what's the mass of the object that's producing this accretion disk, and how tightly constrained is it? And that's where the other observations come in, because it's not just Hubble that helps to make all of this make sense. Here's the Chandra X-ray satellite, and here's a map of the centre of our galaxy. This is optical. You can see the bands of the Milky Way, but the lower one is actually in X-rays. And beautiful stuff. I mean, this is data that's been produced in the last decade. Chandra was launched in 99. It's still going strong. And Sagittarius A is a bright source of X-rays in the constellation of Sagittarius in the direction of the centre of our galaxy. We believe that is about a million solar mass black hole. Now, why? Well, we're going to see. If you zoom in on the X-ray image, then eventually you're looking at a fairly small region, but still of order a few tens of light years across. But as you saw just previously, you've got these lobes of hot gas, exactly as you would predict if there's material falling on. You've got a jet coming out like you see for M87. But the real clincher has actually been ground-based observations. This was done with the Very Large Telescope Array in Chile, and also the Multiple Mirror Telescope, the MMT. And what you see here is a real-time, well, not a real-time, sorry, but real images. It's not a cartoon. And you can see the dates flashing up in the corner. And this is the position of stars close to the centre of our galaxy. Okay, so obviously they're little blobs because you're not seeing them as points of light because of the effects of the atmosphere, but they're still well enough resolved that you can see them moving over a time scale of just a few years. So they're moving really fast. Now the faster the stars move, the more massive the thing pulling them round in their orbits must be. So here's a sort of a cartoon this time. There's the central object. You've got stars moving in highly elliptical orbits around the centre, highly eccentric orbits. Now, here's a, this is an animation, but it's based on the real data, the real positions, but it's just cleaning up all the rest of the image and picking out where we think those stars are. So basically by following the motion of the stars, now watch what happens when it gets close. See how much it speeds up. Now that goes all the way back to Johannes Kepler. If you're moving in an ellipse, then the closer you are to the sun, the faster you move. We don't really notice that in the Earth's case because we follow a pretty circular orbit. But say you take a comet like Halley's Comet, goes very fast when it's close to the sun, goes very slowly when it's further out. So again, we don't see the black hole. But by following the motion of the stars as it goes close by, we can deduce the mass that there is concentrated in that volume in the centre. And there's so much mass in there that you're basically very close to it filling its Schwarzschild radius. So if it isn't a black hole, it must be something even weirder. Because why don't we see it unless we have the obvious explanation of why we don't see it, which is that it's actually got an escape speed that's effectively the speed of light, so even light can't escape from it. Pretty much, yeah. Now the evidence for that is largely circumstantial because of course we can't do this with other galaxies, but we can see like gas in the outermost part of the accretion disk, like you see here. So, you know, that's less conclusive, but it's still pretty convincing that it tells you that there's typically somewhere in, as Mark was asking how much mass, somewhere between a million up to a few billion solar masses concentrated in a very small volume. Now, that also brings us then to the final sort of thing where Hubble comes back into the picture. If we think, as we just commented there, that most galaxies have got these supermassive black holes, well, how did they get them? Well, again, it's because we think most galaxies form through mergers. So if the mergers happened often enough, then sooner or later, a lot of mass is going to build up in the centre. And eventually, if it's, you know, dense enough, you'll get yourself a black hole. But we'd like to know more, and what we know, at least from Hubble, is that as we look very far away, we see lots of examples of merging galaxies. Now, it doesn't prove that they've got supermassive black holes in their centre, but it's consistent with that picture. And one of the ways we know this is by the Hubble Deep Field and the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, which were two images taken just by pointing the Hubble telescope at a little patch of sky and letting it take a very, very long exposure to hopefully see a long, long way back. So here's the first one, the Hubble Deep Field, 1996. And here's a kind of little animation. It's a wee bit gimmicky, but it's quite nice. I thought I would show it anyway. So if you start off at Orion, just a bit below Orion in the sky is where the patch was. And what we're going to see first of all is the sort of equivalent image from various other surveys. DSS's Deep Sky Survey, Palomar Optical Survey, and then GOODS, forget what that acronym stands for, but that was another ground-based survey. And here's the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. We've actually skipped beyond the first Hubble Deep Field. It just gives you a sense of how much further out you were looking than those early surveys. What did we see? Well, we saw galaxies that were in the process of undergoing mergers. Remember, mergers can often trigger a lot of star formation. So you actually don't see all that much, you just see a bit of a splodge in the optical. But here's NICMOS, that's the infrared camera. The infrared picks up the glowing dust, which shrouds the newly forming stars. It means you don't see them so well in the left-hand image, but you see them much better in the right-hand one. And see, here's the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, which shows going even further out. And here are some individually identified galaxies in the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. So look at that one in there. You can probably barely see it in the screen. Number 10. That's it there. Notice how red they are. They're not really red. It's just that they're red shifted. So the light looks redder to us because it's been coming from such a long way away. So most of the really pretty galaxies that you see in the Hubble Ultra Deep Field are actually in the foreground. The ones that we're more interested in are all the really tiny ones, the little smudges, which are much further away. And what you also see, if you look even more closely in the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, is that many of these images of galaxies show indications that they are merging or undergoing interactions between each other. So if you look at that one, you've got two sort of nuclei of galaxies, but with a sort of bridge of material in between. You're absolutely pushing Hubble to the limits here. And the clues are very useful. They are tantalizingly consistent with the idea that galaxies form through mergers, which is what our computer simulations tell us, and that very probably that merger process caused there to be supermassive black holes in the center of galaxies. But we'd like to get a better view. And there are two ways in the next few years that we'll be able to do that. One is just with optical and infrared telescopes to be pushing back even deeper beyond the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, beyond a time when the universe was about 0.7 billion years old, even further back to when the first galaxies were forming, or maybe when the first stars were shining. How are you going to do that? Well, really, an optical telescope will get you so far, but the real problem is there was so much dust around back then, as you saw in this image, that you're just going to see the dust surrounding the stars, and the best way to see that is in the infrared. So the future is really the James Webb telescope, which is going to be launched in 2013, and which will observe the universe in infrared. And that means you want to put it somewhere where infrared radiation is really heat. So you want to put it somewhere away from the heat of the Earth. And indeed, well, you can't do very much about the heat of the sun, but you can a little bit if you give it a sunshade. So that's what this contraption here is. You've got an 8 meter or so size telescope, which consists of a series of individual hexagonal panels, mirrors, focusing the light there, taking it back to a CCD detector. But what the sunshade is doing is trying to shield the telescope from the light of the sun. Now, of course, this is just an artist mock-up, because the galaxies are really a lot further away than this. But nonetheless, what James Webb hopefully will see is some of the very earliest galaxies forming, and the infrared radiation given off by the dust in which they're shrouded. Now, I mentioned there's another way that you can probe galaxies forming, and that's looking further ahead. So James Webb will launch, we hope, in 2013. But somewhere maybe around about 2020, there's another mission. I just realised, I meant to put these slides in. Forgive me if you just bear with me for a minute. I'll find them very quickly, because I know they're easy enough to locate. There's another mission which I'm directly involved in, which is called LISA. So if you'll allow me just to do a wee bit of a plug for LISA. So tie together a few strands. Another rather cheesy artist's impression. What you see here is a distant galaxy that's supposed to be like a quasar. So again, you've got those jets, those active galactic nucleus. But this is a rather special one because it's one in which there are two supermassive black holes. And those supermassive black holes are in the process of merging. Maybe a precursor to, or indeed even a follow-on from two galaxies merging. So maybe the galaxies merge first and then the supermassive black holes merge. If that happens, what it will do is it will produce ripples in space-time, which is what this cartoon is representing, which will send out what we call gravitational waves, which the LISA satellite will be designed to detect. Now, the LISA satellite consists of three spaceships, 5 million kilometres apart, bouncing laser beams back and forth. And what LISA will be trying to detect is changes in the separation of the satellites due to the passage of the gravitational wave. A little bit like how, you know, like a marker buoy in the ocean will bob up and down as an ocean wave passes by. So what's all this got to do with Hubble and James Webb? Well, the key here is that you want to find as many different ways to probe the universe as possible. So mainly in this course we've talked about optical astronomy. But that's so last century. What we really want to do these days is to combine optical observations with infrared, X-rays, gamma rays, and really we now stand on the threshold of adding a whole new window altogether, which is the gravitational wave window. If you have merging supermassive black holes, the gravitational waves coming from it ought to be really strong. We just don't have the technology yet to detect them, but we hope to within the next 5 to 10 years. And essentially, what you're trying to do is to find evidence that there are such mergers happening and perhaps associate them with galaxies merging. Now that could be a real challenge. In actual fact, for the very distant ones, it's easier to see them in gravitational waves than it is to see them in optical or infrared or X-rays or all the other forms of electromagnetic radiation. But that's kind of where we think studies of galaxy formation might be headed over the next 5 to 10 years, an attempt to try to understand both the gravitational waves produced by these objects, like supermassive black holes. We might detect as many as 1,000 per year, but what we also want to do is to see them in electromagnetic radiation. And what did I mean to show you? No, I think that was basically it. I had another animation just to quickly show you. Yeah, that's it, sorry. Skip past the slide, went too far. So the current sort of granddaddy of them all, oh, I got it slightly wrong, I said 18 billion, it's only 17 billion, is a supermassive black hole system that we believe is a binary. So it's a 17 billion solar mass black hole that's being orbited by a 100 million solar mass black hole. And this system is called OG287. If you do a Google search for OG, you find all sorts of interesting pages. But if you put in OG287, you should get this one. And it was observed, it's been observed for quite a long time. What happens is when the supermassive black hole, that's the smaller of the two, passes through the accretion disk of the big one, you get flares given off that are seen in X-rays. So I thought this would be a good thing just to end on, because it emphasises that for all Hubble has made these phenomenal contributions, as I've tried to emphasise throughout this course, the real state of the art in astronomy is to recognise that that's only a tiny fraction of what we see. That you've got to look across the whole electromagnetic spectrum. You would see these flares in X-rays, for example. But in the future, we hope to go even further than that and to look in the gravitational wave spectrum. What we will see, well, nobody really knows, but it's going to be a lot of fun trying to find out. And I just hope that LISA, for example, is going to fly before I retire. Because, I mean, I was there at the beginning of the Hubble mission as a graduate student working away when Hubble was launched. It's been wonderful to see what an impact it's had both on the scientific community but on the wider public. But what I'm very actively involved in is trying to get the public aware of how much more there is, if you might coin a phrase, than meets the eye in astronomy, and also what opportunities lie in the next few decades to exploit all those extra bits of information we can get from across the EM spectrum and even beyond to the gravitational wave spectrum. So maybe in 10 or 20 years time we might be doing a DAIS course, I hope I'm still around to do it, on what we've learned from some of these other telescopes. And I think the one lesson that all these other telescopes can learn from Hubble is that make sure that you invest a lot of time and effort into publicising your results to the wider public, because I think Hubble has been just fabulous at that, absolutely amazing. They've done a wonderful job of doing the science but also projecting that science to a wider public. You know, look at all those images we've seen over the 10 lectures, 9 lectures, and how many of them appear on postcards and posters and t-shirts. So if some of these other missions can even come close to that level of public awareness, then we'll have done a good job. Okie doke.
Tony.